Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
So I was thinking, maybe we should get a wingtip sloat single made at Furnace Record Pressing. What do you think, Patrick? Okay, Patrick, the first thing I want to say about today's episode of Rockin' the Suburbs, I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
The first thing I want to say is I have never been one to invest too much money in audio equipment.
Right.
Okay?
Same here.
I'm looking via video chat here. I see you in your basement.
Yes.
And I see behind you a wall of records, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I think you and I kind of have the same philosophy, which is that if we have some money to spend, we'd probably rather spend it on more records than on upgrading our equipment, right? Like,
that
we have decent... We have decent stereos.
Yeah.
But I've never been, like, an audiophile who needs to have, like, the best, like, high-end sort of equipment, right?
Yeah, right, Jim. And I think you and I have... We may have talked about this on the podcast even fairly recently. You know, we both started out with kind of those component systems, those kind of all-in-one, you know, Fisher stereo that you bought.
Yeah.
And it came with everything. And it did a decent job of reproduction. And that's kind of where we are. I think you and I both have good, you know, pretty decent turntables. And we always take care to get a good cartridge and needle there. But, you know, definitely not in the world of high-end equipment.
I usually will spend... on each component, you know, the receiver, the speakers, the turntable, the CD player, all that stuff, you know, maybe a couple few hundred dollars on each component. So all told, I probably have a stereo that's maybe worth $1,000 or a little bit more than that, something like that, right?
Yep. Total.
Which seems about right to me.
Yep.
But I bring this up because some people are really into audio equipment and setup, and we had the opportunity at Furnace Record Pressing to listen to records on a stereo system that was in like the tens of thousands of dollars, right? Yeah,
a totally different world. One in which you sort of, even with a brand new piece of vinyl that was just cracked out of the plastic, needs to go through a certain pre-process before it's even put on the turntable, right? It needs to be de-staticked or something, I don't know, and cleaned even before you've even played it the first time. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So a while back, it's been several months now, we had the opportunity to visit Furnace Record Pressing in Alexandria, Virginia. And the episode you heard yesterday, we gave you like sort of a little tour of the plant. It's an impressive facility. It's really big. It's got all this like cool machines. It's, you know, some of them are by this point sort of vintage, but they're still workhorses, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's really kind of an amazing thing. So we got a chance to do that. If you didn't hear that, go back and listen to that. But then we sat down with President and CEO Eric Astor.
Yep.
And by the way, President and CEO, you may be picturing this like old guy in a suit, like a three-piece suit, you know, doing his, you know, two martini lunches and that sort of thing. He's not that at all. He's a guy, seemed to be maybe a little bit younger than us, maybe.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Just a really cool guy. Just a guy you'd want to hang out with. I think you're going to be able to tell that from this interview. But anyway, where I'm going with this is when you are making records and you're pressing new vinyl records and you're going to all that care and all that quality control and everything that they do, you want to be able to hear it, I think, you know, on the best possible equipment. So you can hear, like, what does this sound like if some guy does buy it and has a $50,000 stereo, what is he going to hear? So you don't want to just put it on, you know, a little Bluetooth speaker setup, right? You want to be able to hear it there. So they've invested. They have this super high end stereo. It sits in a room there. We got to hang out there and listen to a couple of records. You have to sit. I think he called it like the magic triangle or something like that. There's a perfect spot in the room where you have to sit to hear it just right and everything. And so that was cool. So we listened to some of that. I think he played us a Neil Young record at one point and some other things. But then we just sat down and did like a little interview with Eric, and that's what we're going to play here today.
Yep.
All right. Sounds good. Is that a lot of explanation? All right. It was fun for me. I'm sorry. I had to get that out. It was really a great experience. So
yeah, it really was.
All right. So here we go. Here's the interview with Eric Astor of Furnace Record Pressing. Let's go. So thank you for the tour.
Oh, Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for coming.
This is really, it's fascinating. Just I well, to me, it all seems like magic to begin with. How, like all these years later, from when I was a kid first buying records till now, it's sort of like, how do they do that? How do they get the music in the grooves and all of that? But I knew there was a big manufacturing process to it. I guess I did not realize how extensive it is, like what all goes into making a record. Everyone should take more care of their records, I would say, is my first lesson.
Yeah,
I
learned, yeah. I'm going to go
coming
home
out
and,
of this,
yeah,
right?
Because praise all my records.
It's amazing, yeah, how they're made. So how did you get into this?
So I started when I was young. I was 14, 15. I was in a band, probably not very good, in Tempe, Arizona, and we wanted to put out our own record. And obviously there weren't too many record labels in Tempe, Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona at the time. So we ended up, you know, we knew of Discord Records, and, you know, we learned about them through Flipside and Maximum Rock and Roll, and read about how they figured it out themselves and they started a label. So I did the same thing. So we started Step Forward Records, and that was me and $1,000. And, you know, we put out the band I was in at the time. And then that led to putting out a couple friends' bands. And then when I moved to the East Coast, I started another record label, and we started putting records out. And I was always really, you know, excited about the manufacturing process. And, you know, I was the first one that had like PageMaker before like Cork and InDesign. And I was the guy that was doing all the graphic design for people. So I knew the production side of it pretty well. And so we grew the label, and then we needed better distribution. So we got like 10 other labels to start like a co-op, and it was called Lumberjack. And we distributed, you know, records, and we moved to DC, and we grew that. And then, you know, we were having so many of the labels they had so many problems getting stuff manufactured. It was some vinyl, a lot of CDs. And so I would help them with the production. And then, you know, it got to be to the point where I was doing as much of that as I was doing the distribution stuff. And distribution is hard, and you don't make a lot of money. And manufacturing, there was, you know, it was more suited to me. So I just spun that off into my own company. And then we decided to sell the distribution company. And so 1996 is when we started Furnace. It was all brokering. We got into buying some CD equipment and packaging, and then we, you know, quickly realized that we couldn't do that at, you know, the scale we would need to be, you know, cost effective. So we ended up just being a broker for a long time. And when the vinyl plant that we were using up in New Jersey went out of business, we stopped doing vinyl. And we were just doing CDs until about 10 years ago when, you know, more and more companies were coming to us, hey, do you do vinyl? And, you know, it was when Warner Brothers came and said, hey, we're having a hard time getting a lot of high quality records made. And I knew of this plant in Germany called Palace. And at the time in 2008, we went over there, they were pressing almost no records. You know, they were probably using 10 to 15% of their capacity. And, you know, I come over there and I'm like, I got all this work, and they thought I was crazy. And we just kind of talked them into it, and we were paying up front. And like the first order that we sent to them was like 110,000 Metallica Black albums. And they thought, like, who is this fucking crazy kid from America? And within 3 months, we filled up their entire first shift, and wow, they had to start hiring people. And then we added a second shift, and then we started also using another company in Holland and just keeping up with the demand of the orders that were coming in. And then, you know, I don't know, 6 years ago we built some presses from scratch, because, you know, at the time, 2013, it was 2012, 2013, it was so busy that lead times are like 6 to 9 months, and our clients were getting antsy and pissed off. And we're like, well, we have to do something. So we built five presses from scratch over in Germany. And those are the first automatic presses that had been built since the 70s. And, you know, so it helped us a little bit, but it didn't help us enough. You know, we still were getting crushed. So about 3.5 years ago, we decided to, I just said, we need, in order to keep up and, you know, be, you know, I think the shift away from 180 gram into 140 gram was happening, and people wanted more of the splatters and colors and stuff. And it was just really hard to do that cost effectively in Germany and bring it over. So we thought in order to compete, we needed to do something in the States. So we already had our packaging facility at our old space over in Merrifield. And so we had, you know, number of years under our belt, like bringing records in, doing all the assembly, finishing and shipping. And so we said, well, how hard could it be? And then we started doing this, and it was like all of my money went away. And yeah, we built this place, but we knew that if we did it right and we produced high quality records, that there's always room for quality. You know, if we were just in it to do volume and be in a price war, like there's no way to, there's no longevity there. So we just, you know, we've been slow and steady, and we've focused on, you know, investing in people and, you know, redundancy and making sure that, you know, we were set up for success and that we could press really good records. And so that's where we are right now.
Well, yeah. I mean, slow and steady is one thing though, but that must have been a huge leap though, to say we are going to open a new vinyl record pressing plant in the United States in 2018, right?
Yeah. I mean, we could have done it small, you know, like, you don't need this kind of infrastructure if you're doing like, you know, two or three presses, but if you're doing 14, all of a sudden you go from like these really small boilers and really small chillers and, you know, something that's, you know, you can get in and out of for $1 million. And then all of a sudden, like, I have $1 million worth of pipes alone, right? So, yeah, you have to really scale up. But then again, I didn't go to college. I don't know what else I could do. I can't work for anyone else. Pretty bad employee. But, you know, this is kind of like in my blood. So if anyone was going to be able to do it, I think our staff would be like, cause no one will outwork us. I mean, we work hard. Like, we're super dedicated. Like I said, when we were walking through the plant, we have people that have assembled records for us and mm-hmm. have done shrink wrapping. They've been with us. Like, you know, we have Min and Wei and some other people that have been here for, you know, since day one. And they, yeah, you know, we treat them right. And just the assembly of records, like, you have to be really good at that. Like, you probably read some stories like, oh, like, you know, the wrong record was put in the wrong jacket, or, right, you know, two of the same record. Like, we just don't have those kind of problems usually, because, you know, there's a attention to detail. And we have a whole Vietnamese contingent back there that they take pride in making fun of each other for screwing up. It's like the cultural thing. And they make fun of us. It's great. So, you know, I remember the first day we were putting records together, Min, like, she pulled the record, she picked a record up. She's like, light. And it was like, oh, yeah, someone put one record in instead of two, you know. So it was, you know, we said, like, she's a keeper. And then, you know, just that's really what's kept us in business. And honestly, if we didn't have them, we probably would have moved somewhere a little cheaper. But we knew that we couldn't easily replicate, you know, the level of care and you know, respect for the product that they bring.
But you mean not in Northern Virginia, is what you're saying? Because it's so expensive to be here.
Honestly, we got a pretty good deal here, because this is a weird building. But yeah, we were looking at, like, you know, in Richmond, we mm-hmm. kind of were toying with the idea of maybe Richmond, Detroit. I was helping a company called Shinola develop a turntable.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of we were talking about joining forces for a little bit, and I was like, oh, maybe we'll move to Detroit. But, you know, this is where we live. This is where everyone, you know, where everyone's home is. And, you know, again, it's not about the equipment. It's not about anything but the people. So, you know, if we had to replace anyone, it would have been a big struggle. So keeping everything local and keeping it close to everyone's home is huge.
So just one more thing. So as a young music fan, and you kind of grew up and you saw the different changes in formats and things like that, you can't possibly have thought that there would be this kind of demand for vinyl records at this stage.
So when I was running Lumberjack, that was mid-90s, and no one was buying records except punk kids and indie kids and, you know, jazz reissues. So like, people didn't stop buying records. It's just that Tower Records stopped selling them, and you know, it fell out of the conscious of most people that were buying CDs and then downloads. Like, people thought that was the best. But people that listen to records, like, you know, I have a Drive Like Jehu record that, you know, the some of my favorite bands, and the CD says CDs f-ing blow on the thing. You know, it's like, you know, people knew in the 90s that, you know, CDs, you know, they're convenient for your car, but like, if you wanted to, you know, really immerse yourself into what the band really was focusing on, you'd get the record because the artwork was bigger. You could actually read the lyrics. You could, you know, if you had a turntable, you could play it. It's a more active listening experience. It's not this put it on and you're cooking food and, you know, working, you know, folding laundry. I mean, you had to like pay attention.
Right.
You know, so you get high, listen to music, you're like immersed in it. You know, that's what it's all about. So people forget about that. And then they rediscover it like the last couple of years and like, oh, music's good. Like, it's fun to listen to. Like, I have friends that come over to my house now and they like, we listen to records. Like, that just, you know, didn't happen for a long time. So,
right.
Eric, do you remember who pressed that very first record for you when you put out that first one by your band?
Yeah, it was actually a local in Arizona. There's two pressing plants of all, like, so that's what used to happen. Like, you used to have pressing plants in every major city. So we had two plants. One was called Superior, and they pressed 7 inches, and Wakefield pressed 12 inches. The guy, Mark Huggett, who works for us, who's been pressing records for 40-plus years, he worked at Wakefield.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he worked there when I was there.
Wow.
And, and they were known for really high quality, but Superior pressed 7 inches, and Wakefield pressed her 12 inches.
You remember that feeling when you got that first box of records back and opened it up?
I had a moped, so I would actually take the reels to the cutting studio, and they would cut the lacquers, and they'd put them into a big styrofoam container, and then I'd strap them onto the back of my scooter in 110 degree heat and drive them to the pressing plant. Just like things that you just shouldn't do.
Early on,
you didn't know. It's all
punk
records, you know. It's like, not like you're gonna, it's gonna sound any better.
You recorded it on a boombox anyway.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's kind of like, it was all DIY. And then we'd go down, and my friend's dad used to run a housing like a home building company. So we would make the covers on the copier late at night.
Right.
And, you know, fold them up and, you know, just do everything by hand, and you know, yeah, so that's, and then you could put one ad in Maximum Rock and Roll and sell 1,000 via mail order. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every record that we put out, Jello Biafra would order one, like these completists, you know. So, yeah, like we would sell like 1,000 records at least through the mail just by putting two or three ads out.
That's what it was in the 90s. I did it myself. Maximum Rock and Roll, Forced Exposure, Touch and Go, all those places. You saw the ad in the back and you sent away your $3 or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like 87, 88, 89. That was the heyday of like Maximum Rock and Roll, flip side. And then the early 90s came around. And if you put in an ad in Magnet, Maximum, flip side, and like five magazines, you are guaranteed you could sell 10,000 of anything. Yeah. Nowadays, like, major labels are psyched if you sell 10,000 to 15,000 records, which is crazy because bands used to get dropped for selling a 500,000 records.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, the industry is totally crazy and changed. I don't know how anyone makes any money anymore, but like, you know, the artists love vinyl. So gotta love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so the very first musician interview we did on the old podcast, the very first one was Dave Wakeling.
That's right.
This was about 4 years ago, and he said, I think at that point he had like recorded a new English Beat record, the first new one, you know, in however many years, decades, but they kept delaying the release date because they couldn't get the vinyl pressed. Yeah. That was his thing. You know, he's like, I don't know when this is ever going to come out because we can't get the vinyl pressed because every place was at capacity. So is that still happening today?
No.
Is there still room for growth? What's going on
in the industry? No, it's slowed. I mean, you know, I think that because people started making new equipment, more pressing plants have come online, which has been a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing for us, because, you know, the small bands and small labels, like regional labels, they were kind of getting shut out. Mm-hmm. And So around that time, you know, lead times were, you know, 4 to 6 to 7 months.
Yeah.
Now they're back down to like 6 weeks from test press approval, which is, you know, kind of where it should be. But there's plenty of work. And I think, again, you know, if you focus on quality, like, you know, there's people that are willing to pay a little extra and wait a little bit more, you know, to get really good quality records. So most of the records we press, it'll say on the outside, pressed at Palace, which is, you know, so we run Palace USA in addition to Furnace Record Pressing. So between the two, you know, people put our names on the records. So, you know, if you go to Discogs and someone's in a store, you see all these record nerds like looking things up on Discog, and they'll see, they're trying to find out where it's pressed. So we're pretty happy to say that, you know, amongst the record nerd people, that, you know, are they going to spend $25 on a record? Or are they not? If they see our name, they usually will buy it because they know that it's been pressed well. So, you know, so it's a little bit more accessible now. It's a little like you're not waiting 4 or 5 months anymore. Yeah, I mean, it definitely takes longer to press records than it does to make a CD or
right.
put something up.
But it's obviously there must be even more demand because you're continuing to expand, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, I think there's a couple things. I think there's people that are, you know, the industry has, there's a lot more education. So whereas people used to buy a record, now they, all of it, like, so my friend Rob, he told me the other day, he's like, I'm like 25 grand into my record collection since I started buying vinyl again 3-4 years ago. And he was showing me his Discogs. He's like, you know, I spent like $600 in 2015 and then like, $4,000 in 2016 and like $15,000 last, you know, so I'm like, holy shit. But, you know, so he used to just buy records. Now he's like, oh, who pressed it?
Right.
So you have a whole bunch of people that have, you know, over the last 10 years, because 10 years ago, was it 10 years ago? Or no, it was almost 12 years ago was the first record store day, 2007. So, you know, you have people that now, you know, they were reintroduced, you know, then to vinyl, and then they started dabbling, and then all of a sudden it becomes a lifestyle, right. And then it becomes a necessity. Yeah. So those people that know what they're doing, they are paying attention to who's pressing it. And so I think there's now people that are gravitating away from the guys that don't press good records. And that's where we think that we have a shot because, right. You know, there's a lot of assembly line, you know, manufacturers that don't care what they press, and you know, and there's certain people that they don't care and they'll go to them, but you know, I think that there's a lot of people that are graduating up to higher expectations, and then you have the music buying public that are demanding it. So yeah, I think that's where we sit. Like, we won't get all the work, but we'll get the most important stuff.
Mm-hmm. So I have to ask this though, because I'm sure there are a lot of naysayers out there. Are you worried that that the vinyl resurgence is a fad, that this,
I mean,
could end?
8 years ago, yes. 7 years ago, yes. And then like all of a sudden it's like, you know, I look at the hardware hardware business is going like crazy. Yeah. So as soon as the hardware business slows down, then I'm worried.
Okay.
Because, you know, it was either last Christmas, not 2018, but 2017, the number one consumer electronic good sold on Amazon was a turntable. So, you know, that's a lot of turntables. My friends at VPI, they're making more turntables now than they ever have. And they've been making turntables for 40 years. You know, and then you have Project in Czech Republic. They're making tons of turntables. Audio Technica. So Technics stopped making turntables because all of their molds blew out. And they didn't want to spend another $1 million like remaking the mold. So all the like the SL1200, all those like awesome legendary turntables,
stuff, yeah.
Like they were all like using the same plastic molds from what, you know, forever ago. And so Audio Technica, the same thing. They made the LP120, and now they're making a new. They're revamping all their molds, which means that they're spending a. I have a company called Vinyl Style, and we created this deep groove cleaner. Hmm. And, you know, just a couple pieces of plastic, it costs $40,000 to make the molds. So, think of all those different parts and pieces that go into a turntable. You need a plastic mold for all that stuff. So you have companies that are willing to spend millions of dollars on new molds to make new turntables. I mean, that means that they're selling a lot of turntables and they think that, you know, the market is strong going forward. So, you know, I help, like I was mentioning that Shinola Runwell turntable. I mean, of all the audio stuff that Shinola did, like the only thing that's left is the turntable and the speakers, and they can't make enough at $2,500 a clip. They're selling like 60 wow. to 70 turntables a
wow.
month.
Wow.
So, you know, again, you know, you have $300 turntables, like, and anyone that's listening, if you want a great turntable, you can buy like a Project, a Debut, or you can buy this Audio Technica LP120. Thing is awesome for $300 or mm-hmm. $250. I mean, it's really good. So, you know, you can get in for like $300. You can buy like $100 pair of powered speakers. And then from there, you can like, you know, graduate up. But all of those people that are making that entry level, even, you know, the $1,000 turntables, they're doing very well. So I don't think it's a fad. I think like when people start investing thousands of dollars into their collection, but also they see that the quality of the listening experience is better for them. Maybe not everyone has a $50,000, you know, setup right. like I do in back of me, but you know, when you hear the difference. But it's also like the quality of the listening experience and like hanging out with your friends yeah. and just like actually immersing yourself in the music for 20 minutes at a time, slowing down a little bit. Yeah. Like we're all that's running all the time, yep. you know, like sitting down and actually listening to something on, you know, like that's kind of like a pleasure that we haven't allowed ourselves in a long time. So, you yeah, know, any totally. Excuse to like, you know, just hang out, get drunk, smoke some weed, listen to music, whatever you want to do. Like that's like, that's kind of an experience that people aren't going to give up anytime soon. So, you know, and also like they've tried to kill the vinyl format so many times and it keeps coming back. You don't remember 8-tracks, cassettes, you know, the people that do cassettes, but cassettes kind of suck. Let's all admit it. But vinyl actually is good. You know, they haven't changed the technology since 1948. Palace was, you know, they started their plant in 1949. They've been pressing records since 1949 continuously. And it's been the same record. You know, the PVC gets a little better, the plating gets a little better, the cutting gets a little better. But, you know, we just listen to Neil Young. We listen to some, you know, I was listening to the Rubber Soul double 45 that I was telling you about. Like, that record was recorded in the mid-60s. Sounds as good as anything that's being yeah, recorded right. now. And it's being played on the same, you know, format that they listened to then. You know, so,
right.
you know, you can listen to something on a Marantz stereo from the 70s and the shit's going to sound amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's you can't really improve on, you know, near perfection. And I think that's where vinyl is. You can get really close, but you don't have the cover. You don't have like the yeah. excuse to hang out. You don't have like the, I don't know. There's something about it. That's yeah.
It
interesting.
Was, it reminds, it takes me back to when I was in high school and would like, you know, open up a record and lie down on the bed and just, you know, follow the lyrics or liner notes or whatever while I was playing in my bedroom, you know, that's an experience, you know, and it's different than what my son who's 14 now does, which is just to have his like wireless Bluetooth yeah. headphones on all the time as he walks around the house, just listening to whatever, you know, through yeah. a streaming
and
service.
And right? I do that too. I mean, I do woodworking, so I'm at my shop and I'm doing the same thing. But, you know, when you come in, you can have a different experience. Right. So not every record that I listen to is on vinyl and not every record is pressed on vinyl. So, you know, it's not an either or, it's kind of an and.
Right. right.
And, you know, whatever. I mean, if you don't like vinyl, that's cool too. Like, just listen to music. Yeah. Just do something.
You know, and one thing on top of all this, Eric, that's interesting to me is that I love that on Furnace's website, if I am an indie band who's able to scrape together $1,000, I can still order a 7-inch, yeah. you know, and 300 copies from you. How important is that, you know, to still have that open to the GarageBand consumer that can pick out a colored vinyl 7-inch and put their 5 songs out?
Well, it's kind of where I started, so it's really important because, you know, that's where the, you know, not to get all sappy, but that's where the excitement comes from, yeah. you know, yeah, that's absolutely. Where you, when you see someone actually, you know, I can send a record to a major label and I don't hear anything. Like, if I don't hear anything, that's good news. But when someone comes and picks up their records here and they're like, holy shit, and they take it out of the sleeve and everyone's like high-fiving.
Must be,
you know,
amazing.
That's psyched because, you know, I know what it takes to, like, they scraped up all the money in the world to record it. And then they had to scrape up some more money or steal some money, whatever, to press it. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, it's not easy to do it. It's not cheap to do it. So, and there's like a little validation. Like, back when I was pressing records, there was a time, like, when Maximum Rock and Roll stopped reviewing demos. So all of a sudden, anyone could, like, throw in a demo tape to be reviewed, and they were just deluged with demo tapes because you could do that at your house,
pretty
right?
Easily, yeah.
So then they said, we're only going to, we don't have the bandwidth to, like, do all this, so we're only going to review records. And it was just, everyone was complaining. So it's kind of like that now, right? So anyone can throw something on SoundCloud, and it's right. Good. There's a democracy to that of music. Like, you know, you shouldn't have to have money to put out something, right? But there's also something kind of interesting and kind of cool to actually put something out physically and see it. And, you know, there's a passion. There's obviously got to be a passion there that you want to spend, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 putting something out on a record versus just throwing it up on SoundCloud,
right.
Where it's going to get absorbed into the netherworld. Cause, you know, people will send me like, hey, check out my band. I go there and there's like 6 listens and it's like, right. You know, that's cool, you know, but, you know, it's like, you know, build up your listens, you know, and then play out and, you know, do it like old school where you like build your chops and then, oh, I have a fan base and I can put out 100 records, yeah, 200 right. records and I can sell them. Yeah. You know, that's kind of like that's a cool thing to do. And it's like something to aspire to. And, you know, I like the fact that we can do that for people. And I like the fact that people actually give a shit to do it still.
I think it's one of the most amazing things about this whole operation, and I was excited to come here and see this, Jim, but when I actually got here, I was even more excited to go through and just see what it's about and talk to Eric about his philosophy, because it definitely hits home with me. You know, I was able to have that same thrill of having a crappy garage band and getting that box of records by UPS and going, oh my God,
it's exciting,
is real.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, it's indescribable how exciting.
And it makes you also, I think, as a band, really think about this music. Is this the song that we want to have on this record? Right. Right. Exactly.
And well, if you ever get a chance to watch the Foo Fighters documentary when they recorded Wasting Light, I think in Dave Grohl's house, they decided they're gonna record was it Wasting Light? Yeah. And it was they were gonna record on to analog tape, and he set up a tent in his backyard, so they would be like, oh shit, I gotta play it, and you just see him out there, like the bass player's like trying to nail it, because you know, you're recording the tape. You can't fix it in post, you know?
Right.
You gotta nail it. So, like, you know, it's you have to be very you know, mindful of what you're doing, you know, not only to play music that is going to be recorded on the analog, but also, like, you know, the inner track of a record sounds worse than the outer. So you know, back in the day, you'd always put the hits on the outside,
right.
And then you put the ballads and the soft songs on the inside, right? So there's just physics that are involved in records that, you know, you didn't have to care. And then when you got to a CD, like, we'll put out 17 songs.
Right.
It's like, well,
right.
Guess what? You can really only write 8 good ones. So 10 of them suck.
Right.
So, you know, there's a reason why, like, you know, Rush put out a record every year and it was 8 of their best songs and they had time to, like, record another 8. You know, think about that. Like,
true.
Van Halen was recording a record a year for the first, like, 4 years and they all fucking killed it.
Yeah.
And, you know, say what you will, I like everything up to 1984. So, but they were doing it at a breakneck pace, and then you have, like, you know, when the CD came, is like, well, we can fit 72 minutes
right.
of music. Well, should you?
Right, exactly.
Like the new Norah Jones records is 7 songs.
Right,
it's perfect.
Right,
it's like I wrote 7 awesome songs, and this is what I'm going to put out, and that's what you should. Like, I'd rather have 7 songs and pay full price for 7 awesome songs than, you know, 16 songs and 3 songs are good, and that's basically what. You know, and vinyl, you have a cap. Like, you know, you can't really cut more than, you can cut 25 minutes aside and they sound like shit. But like, you know, we tell people 18 to 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so you have 40 minutes with the music, and that's really all that's you good. Need yeah. to do, right? Yeah. Like,
that's a
anything
good record.
More than that, like, you're either super prolific and you deserve whatever you get, or like, did the Beatles ever put out a fucking 80-minute record? No. Well, maybe. Yeah, when two record it's
maybe,
at, right?
Yeah, one.
But,
yeah.
You know,
maybe one
most time. Of them, yeah. you know, hey, like, that's all you need. That's all mm-hmm. you get. Mm-hmm. Leave them wanting more. Final is the perfect format for that.
That's always why I fell in love with Discord bands, because they would play 30 minutes and not an encore and go off stage. You know, it's the best thing in the world.
And then, but, you know, and one of the things that's actually kind of annoying with vinyl making a comeback is that the bands in, like, say, the 90s that only only put out stuff on CD, or the label, really, you know, just putting out on CD. And like you said, they have the 17 songs or however many minutes that ends up being. Now when they go to reissue it on vinyl, it doesn't fit
right
on a disc. And so then, but it's like too short to make it a double album. Right. And you have all those kind of weird things.
I always tell people,
happen.
Put your best songs on vinyl and then put all your shitty songs on a download card.
There you go.
And then the fans still get the whole thing. But really, like, you know, does that one song really need to be on there? Like, if you can't afford to do a one LP set, and no one wants to buy a two LP set that's $40 and has a bunch of songs they don't care about. Right. So, you know, the thing about vinyl that we tell people is, like, you know, you don't have to put the same sequence, you know, that you put on the CD with the, like, mix it up. Like, you don't have to be precious about it. Like, if that one song, the fourth song, is a loud song, well, put it on the first track on side B. Like, it doesn't, unless it tells a story, like, you can do yeah. whatever you want.
Yeah.
But, you know, people just don't, I think people are starting to realize that, but a lot of people, like, they just feel like everything has to be uniform. And, like, vinyl makes, if you think about it, vinyl makes no sense. It weighs a lot. It's a pain in the ass. It's expensive. Like, it is still, like, you talk about magical. Like, it's kind of magical that it even works.
Right.
If you look at the physics and the science that went into making a record, it's like, how the fuck did they come up with this stuff, right? So, you know, like, I'm still super impressed. And, like, when people are like, how does a turntable work? I'm like, I don't know. Let's go look at the thing again. We made a chart, like, you know, how does, you know, vinyl playback demystify? Because it's super crazy. So you can mix it up. You don't have to be like, you can do whatever you want. Like, it's crazy enough. It's magical. Just do whatever you want with it and have fun with it. Because it's, I think people are a little too precious with music sometimes. And sometimes, yeah, like, you know, there's a lot of people that buy equipment, like what's behind me. And it's like, they, and you see it a lot. Like, you can tell, like, people aren't music fans necessarily, but they're like audio fans, yes. you know? And there's a stereotype I have. Like, you know, you go to these audio shows and it's kind of like, you know, but they get more into the, like, the playback, and they never hear the music.
Like the sonics.
Like, they listen,
right?
but yeah. they don't hear the music yeah. sometimes. Yeah. And, like, you know, if you just hear the music and that's all you care about, then do whatever you want with the vinyl. You know, you have all this crazy fun stuff, like, you know, like a canvas for the art, and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
You just do whatever you want to do. Have fun.
Eric Astor, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me on our show. Thanks for coming by.
Really amazing.
Okay, and we thank Eric for his time.
Absolutely.
So great. I know he's super busy. He's, you know, growing this business. He's invested a lot of money in it, and it's really taken off. At the point we talked with him, he was already talking about adding, like, more shifts to be able to make more
yep.
records.
Yep.
It's impressive how much product they put out, and I'm sure he's even busier today than he was when we talked with him. So we really appreciate the time we got.
Totally. It's great that he's doing what he's doing. And also, you know, he's not necessarily just working with anybody that he can get work from. I mean, he's working with big companies and big artists, as yeah. well as working with Discord Records, who's putting out a new record that E. McKay is involved with, along with Amy Farina and Joe Lally from Fugazi, that's going to be coming out in June, here in the next month, on his, on Ian's new and new band with Amy and Joe, and that was pressed at Furnace too. So
that's cool.
It's cool that he's doing that stuff.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we talked a little bit about this with him, and I think you heard some of that. But I do think it's really important to say that, you know, Furnace makes the bulk of its revenue, I think you said, through relationships with the major labels and some of the big indie labels, and they get big orders. You know, these guys are, you know, there aren't that many people pressing vinyl these days.
Nope.
And what he's running here is, you know, a big part of that ecosystem.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
So there's that. But he also, as he said, they encourage people, just, you know, small indie labels or just, you know, people just are doing something on their own to check them out. You can go to their website and you can get a quote. You know, they want to work with you. And so I think that's really cool too.
Exactly. And kudos to him for keeping that balance of keeping his business profitable and running, and also being able to help out, you know, anybody who wants to take the step from, as you said, uploading it to SoundCloud or recording it in your basement, to having something real and physical and tangible that means just a little bit more, I think, to some people.
So anyway, go check out their website. It's furnacemfg.com. Mm-hmm. I assume that means furnacemanufacturing.com.
Probably.
furnacemfg.com. So check that out. Really cool people. Really great great thing that they're doing. And you know, if there's any business that you want to support, I would say the record business should be right up there at the top of your list.
Amen. Amen, all sir.
All right. So I don't know what we're going to do next week. We're going to come up with something over the weekend.
Yeah.
You'll hear it. I'm exhausted. I need to take a nap.
You need a sabbatical. Yeah.
All right. So, but if anyone would like to comment at all on these episodes, or if anybody, you know, has any insight into making records or what have you, want to get in on this conversation, call and leave a message, 612-440-1984. And we'll put your voice on an upcoming episode, or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at Suburbs Pod. And also, speaking of physical product, go to suburbspod.com and you can find Rock in the Suburbs merchandise for sale. No records yet.
Not yet. Not
maybe
yet.
In the future, but other cool stuff like pint glasses, t-shirts, and bottle openers and stickers, all of that. Suburbspod.com. All right, let's get out of here.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, it's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
Thanks again to Eric, and we'll talk to you guys soon. But I got a Willie Waylon and a Woody Guthrie, Jimmy Buffett, I love it, and a Bobby Gentry, Jerry Jeff, Bob Dylan, Donnie Fritz, Dead in the Doors, Patsy Cline, John Prine, and more. I got Jackson Brown, Towns, Van Zandt, Zeppelin, Skinner, Jerry Chapin, Doc Park, Van Halen, Rita, Chris, Keith Fox, and Country Joe, and he was playing with the fish, you know. I got Emmy Lou, James Taylor, Jimmy Rogers, Hank Williams, and Mojo Nixon, Hendrix, Haggard, and a whole lot more. I got all of Booker T's, Tom T. Hall's, Bobby Bear, Belafonte, and the New York Dolls, Billy Joe, Jimmy Croce, Kiss Crosby, Stills, and Nash, John June, and the Roseanne Cash. I got Forbert, Fromhole, Stevie Ray, T-Birds, Yardbird, Sam and Dave, and it's some of y'all might have guessed already. I got piles and piles and piles of Tom Petty in that dusty old pile of vinyl records I got sitting on my floor.
Oh yeah, so Neil Young, Harvest. We pressed that, when we first pressed that for Warner Brothers, there was a lot of talk on the internet forum not to be named, and all these people were like complaining about, oh, this thing sucks, it's got a pop on it, how dare they, you know anyway, long story short, pages of complaints. And then I asked, you know, the label, and I asked the Neil Young people, like, what are they talking about, this record's flawless. And they said, well, no, there's a part where he's strumming his guitar and he hits the pick to the pick guard, and no one's heard it and probably 30 years, because this is the first time we've, you know, cut from the analog tapes and remastered it. And so, yeah, you're hearing a level of clarity that you haven't heard on the radio or on a CD transfer or any of that stuff. So it was the first time that someone's actually heard it like that in a long time. And it was probably a better transfer than it was back in the day, because the, you know, quality of the pressing actually can go up. So if you're using the same analog tape, you know, it's well preserved, but now you have better cutting technology, better PVC, better pressing, you know, awareness. You know, you can make a better record now than you could back then, even on 40-year-old tape. So, you know, things can be better, you know, and you can hear music for the first time all over again, you know, transferring some of these old analog tapes.
That's amazing.
So it went from the worst pressing of Neil Young to the best one.
Yeah, and then everyone's like, this is the best thing ever. I can't believe it. You can hear this level of clarity.